I'm Mindy Todd. Welcome to The Point. How do you define success? I guess that could depend on who you ask. Are we talking about career success, personal success? Today, we discuss the psychology of success and look at some of the latest research and what it tells us about how people acquire high levels of skill. Psychologist Michael Abruzzese and psychiatrist Mark Whaley are here to join us with their thoughts on the subject. Good morning to you both.
Hi, Mindy.
Morning, Mindy.
All right, so if you were to go out and poll some people on the street as to the definition of success, I would suspect we'd get some very different answers.
Right. Everyone has to decide on what their definition of success is. Some people, for example, will choose raising a good family as their definition of success. Other people want to be a highly achieving executive in some organization. Some people consider to have as much freedom as possible a success, you know, how to get freedom in an unfree world. So it really depends on how you want to define success. And we'll be talking about a couple of different ways to define success. We'll be talking about the research behind success. You mentioned skills building, and I'm going to talk about the more pop psychology aspects of success as seen on television and stuff like that.
Sure. Yeah, it's situation specific and people specific, obviously, what you're doing, what you're trying to do. But there certainly are some things in common. One problem with success, achieving success, is it can be addictive. And I think we have to keep that in mind as a downside of being too driven to be so focused on one particular measure of success, whether it be money or prestige. That can be a lot of suffering can come from that.
Now, would this be somebody with an addictive personality to begin with, or this can happen to anybody?
Well, it's interesting to talk about addictive personality. We have to define what that is. If you talk about a condition response, then the condition response can be that we condition ourselves. Behavioral psychologists would say that we condition ourselves to a life of mediocrity or routine or a repetitive self-sabotaging and failure, or we can utilize the same abilities inside our brain and our behavior to develop the habit of success. So if you just talk about addictive personality like a repetitive conditioned habit, yeah, you can say it is that.
Sure. Yeah, sure. And also, if you define success as being peaceful, compassionate, giving, involved with others, but still mediocre in by other measures, mm-hmm. You're still successful. So it depends on how you look at it, what your philosophy is.
Yeah, I think on the East Coast, certainly in America compared to Europe, and I think more in the East Coast, maybe on the coasts in general instead of the heartland, people define success as by how much money you make and the kind of company you work in. But if you're in the heartland, it's hard for me to believe that if you're in Kansas or if you're someplace in Michigan that you define success as being a captain of industry, because I just don't think the lifestyle out there or the values they have is different. And in the field of psychology, which is not really paid much attention to now, is called values clarification, helping people identify what in fact their values are. And it's hard to do that when you're in an environment where everyone telling you that your values should be at odds with everything they taught you in grammar school, mm-hmm. everything you learned from the books you read, the great novels, everything you learned in church or Sunday school, and you have to be something different than what Mark talked about, the moral development of success. So it depends on how you want to look at that. Are you talking about the moral development or the moral equivalent of success, or the kind of success that society brands as being successful?
Yeah, there is some research that holds in on that a little bit. When people are surveyed in terms of how they want to raise successful children, in other words, what is their hope-for result, surprisingly, most people say they would like to raise compassionate, caring kids as opposed to achieving kids. Now, certainly, there's efforts on both ends. It's not an either or. But when asked what their preference is, people value, at least in the asking situation, compassion, caring, and empathic kids.
Right. An interesting story about that. When my first child was born, we were interviewing pediatricians and obstetricians, and one of the nurses was telling us a story of natural childbirth versus the regular medical childbirth, and she told a story about how someone who went through all the right things to do a totally natural childbirth, 20 years later, their son grew up to be a carpenter on Cape Cod, whereas the very identical patient who came in to go through the regular way with the medication, all that kind of stuff, her son grew up to be a lawyer. And I guess she was trying to suggest that maybe being a lawyer was better than being a carpenter. Maybe that's what she was suggesting. But certainly, probably the child who grew up to be the carpenter was very consistent, I would hope, with the kind of goals and aspirations that his mom and his dad have about the kind of way you want to live your life and what's important to you.
I wouldn't be surprised if that carpenter made a lot more money than the lawyer, to
on
tell
Cape
you the
Cod,
truth.
That certainly could be sure, yeah.
Going back to you mentioned about the Midwest, I lived in the Midwest, and I can still remember a neighbor saying to me, so how much money do you make over there at that TV station? How much money did you pay for that house? So I don't know about that. So not surprising, researchers over the past century determined intelligence is a factor in career success, but it may be a matter of how you are smart, Mark?
Yeah, that's right. Intelligence definitely is a factor. Cognitive intelligence, we're talking about IQ score, definitely is a factor. If your goal is to be earn a PhD in nuclear physics, you're going to be hampered with an average IQ, and your chances are pretty slim that you're going to get there. But if you have a superior IQ, cognitive ability, your chances are much better if that's your goal to proceed. So definitely it's involved. But then when you look at some other measures of success, like in business, for instance, and especially nowadays where our economy is around service and interaction, the people that are successful are the ones that have what we call a high emotional intelligence, the ones that have good self-awareness, good ability to relate to people, to connect with, to articulate, build a team as opposed to put down others, et cetera, or knowledge of how to interact and have people join you for a goal. Those are the people that generally rise in the corporations, for instance.
Yeah, Mark is talking really about what used to be called street smarts.
Mm-hmm.
And a person with average intelligence probably does not – well, you do have a slight shot at becoming the kind of engineer that Mark talked about. If you want to get a PhD, you have a slight shot about doing that, but you have a better shot at becoming that guy's boss and running his department.
Right.
And a lot of people I know, they decide they can't go to law school, they can't make it in law school, but they start a business, they're really successful. They have a whole bunch of young lawyers working for them,
mm-hmm.
doing whatever they want to do. So mm-hmm. it's important, again, to talk about how you define success. So if you have the one thing in your heart and soul is become a PhD physicist, I think that's probably a recipe for psychological failure, not real failure in life, but psychological failure. Because you think, geez, you know, I always wanted to do such and such. But if you just wanted to work in the field, if you want to make a huge contribution in the field, one would suggest that being the boss of a research department for engineers does a lot more for the betterment of society than just being one engineer, you know, working alone in their cubicle. So there are a number of different ways to become successful in your chosen field. If only you would expand your horizons and take a look at your strengths and try and find a good match for your strengths, not to try and be the proverbial square peg in the round hole.
Yeah, makes a lot of sense.
When you're talking emotional intelligence here and you're talking about being a good communicator and motivating a team, and all I can think of, last weekend I watched that movie, The Wolf of Wall Street. Have you seen it?
Oh, yeah.
This is based on a real person, but you can see where this guy is the best salesman. And after he gets out of jail for all the things he did wrong, he ends up being a motivational speaker.
Right.
But somebody else could not have done what he did.
That's right.
Yeah.
That's right. Yeah, no, he had emotional intelligence.
Yeah.
Well, I think we might want to segue into on a later show topic of sociopathic and psychopathic
right.
behavior. And I'll just throw out the fact that in business and many other organizations, political, entertainment, business, sociopathy is kind of like cream. It tends to rise to the top.
Yeah.
So that's where you get the saying, nice guys finish last, because you're not going to go in there and do all the things that some of these other guys do to get to the top because you have a different value system.
Sure.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
And to be the Wolf of Wall Street, and you really have to be willing and desiring to snooker people.
Yeah.
And not everyone is willing to
do
that.
Which
he did,
yeah.
That's a price that they don't want to pay.
Right.
That's right.
So can you improve your emotional intelligence?
The answer is yes. And it takes attention, mindfulness. The things we do in psychotherapy, really, is what it takes to be aware of yourself and really kind of hone your ability to put yourself in somebody else's shoes and see what their motivations are. That way you can relate to them in a way that is going to enhance your success. So, yes, it can be improved. And there are trainings and Lectures, self-help books, et cetera. So it's not something that's, set and forget it. It is something that develops over time. And obviously, research shows that it has most to do with what your early childhood experiences are. People that are raised in abusive situations are probably have a handicap. With emotional intelligence. Not that they can't overcome it, but it's a strike against them. But it can be grown.
It also depends on the kind of environment you're in. I talked before about a good match. It's important to understand that you can be successful in the kind of environment that tends to foster the success for your personality type, intelligence level, emotional level, depending on how you want to choose your individual variables for being successful. That's why some people rise to the top in being a gang. Mm. Well, you couldn't really take them necessarily and put them into a more polished kind of environment. And it's said that it's easier for an educated person to pretend to be a barbarian than it is for a barbarian to pretend to be an educated person. So there are some cultural and sociological limits to how far we can stretch ourselves because of our early childhood education, our early cultural environment. And those limits, those boundaries can be pressed, and some people can really press them quite a bit. But you really have to have a big desire to press them. Otherwise, we kind of are limited by the kind of pasture we can play in, by the kind of our by type of our genetics and also our early childhood education.
Right. You're talking about character formation in a way, and obviously that's critical, and character formation comes from childhood, the large pieces of it also comes from genetics, but it can be modified over time and enhanced in certain directions, especially when we're talking about emotional intelligence.
Yeah. So some information that you sent over, I thought this was interesting, talking about character development. Psychologist Christopher Bryan, who finds that for moral behaviors, nouns work better than verbs. To get 3 to 6-year-olds to help with a task rather than inviting them to help, it was 22 to 29% more effective to encourage them to be a helper. Cheating was cut in half when instead of please don't cheat, participants were told please don't be a cheater.
Yeah, that was fascinating.
That was really interesting.
Interesting research. And there the research is around the development of character, basically. And you mentioned that was the way it showed in 3 to 6 years old. 3 to 6 year old kids that nouns were better. Also, complimenting a child's character that as opposed to just the behavior works better in terms of developing confidence and success than does just, complimenting their behavior. So that talking about a person or a child as being a very good helper is better than complimenting what you did here was nice. They incorporate it because there's a kind of a critical age in which character formation is formed. And it, at least for this point, the research showed it was the magic age was around 8, it made most difference if you complimented the child's, this is an experiment that they're doing,
right.
If you complimented the child's character as opposed to just the behavior. Both work, but you get more mileage out of the character commentary. Whereas by the time they're adolescents, the differences in the research blurred. It didn't matter whether you complimented character or behavior. So, again, it just points to the importance of early childhood guidance and responsiveness of the adults to the child's specific needs at that point. And there's ways of communicating. So when you're talking about can you modify this? It's most modifiable, obviously, in earlier childhood. And there's some techniques that the research shows us are more helpful than others. Like you just said, engaging the young child, the 3 to 6 year old, by complimenting their character, more or less, giving them a goal that is internalized. Whereas if you just compliment their behavior, then they come to think that they're only going to do it for the behavior. That's the reward. And it doesn't really stick. But this is a way of internalizing what you want.
Well, one of the drawbacks of the way the research indicates it's best to raise kids is that the real world simply doesn't work in that manner. Certainly there was a lot of hand-waving and hurrahs when we came up with the idea of a token reward system that was developed in the old psychiatric hospitals in the 50s, 60s, and 70s, and that just does not work in the real world. And so kids who do, and most kids, unless there's something that's gone very wrong in their very early development or their genetic makeup, most kids are very moral creatures when they start out. And then they go through their kindergarten, everybody holds hands and everyone gets along together in the first grade and preschool. Everything is fine. It doesn't get to be a real source of conflict with kids until they get to be the older kids, maybe fifth grade, sixth grade, but certainly by middle school, where they realize that this is not the world that they were prepared to be raised in, because the vast majority of other kids haven't been raised that way. And the teachers try hard to sort of get them to change. But if the parents aren't helping out, if the environment is not helping out, it's really extremely difficult. And as early as that, we're talking about major social remediation as opposed to education and training. You really have to want to change. You have to really realize that, whoop, this is something that I don't want to go down this road. And then you can get the coaching and the mentorship you need to change on that. But in my opinion, sadly, most people just don't want to do that. It takes a lot of work, and they don't see the payback. They see the people who are the cheaters getting ahead.
Yes.
Whether someone, you know, cheats in front of you by stepping in front of you in the checkout line, or a person cuts you off in traffic, or the guy who's not as skilled as you are schmoozes better and he gets the promotion. People see that just doesn't work for them to be the kind of moral person that they were raised to be. And when they try to play the game, oftentimes they stumble so badly because they don't have that other set of skills, and they wind up really hurting themselves even more.
Sure.
Interesting point.
Yeah, it's tough.
We're talking about the psychology of success. 866-999-4626 is our toll-free number if you'd like to join the conversation. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@capeendislands.org. We'll talk more after a break. You're listening to The Point. We are talking about the psychology of success with psychologist Michael Abbruzzese and psychiatrist Mark Whaley. 866-999-4626 is our toll-free number if you'd like to join the conversation. 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. Confidence and success, which comes first? It's like the chicken or the egg.
Right. Well, self-confidence is always really a good thing to have, no matter what you do. But many people who seek extreme success are not very confident people. A lot of very strong performers, singers, people in theater, show business, they're very shy. They don't have any confidence in their ability at all.
And insecure.
Right, and very insecure. And you put them on the stage and they are just golden. They're made of steel. And you take them off the stage and they are just jello. So it's hard to say what kind of confidence people have. I guess there are more than one kinds of confidence you can have. You can have confidence in your ability. You can be a magnificent mathematician, but if you don't get the breaks, if you're not able to attract the attention of a mathematics mentor in your college, you're not going to go very far, even though you could be a superb mathematician.
Sure.
So self-confidence is not the be-all and end-all. People can be very self-confident in their personal life and not confident in their business life. So it's kind of a dual-edged sword. But having confidence in your ability to survive whatever new experience you put yourself through is very important, and is probably more important to what they call stretch the envelope. Put yourself in new kinds of positions where you actually get turned down, where you actually get some negative kind of feedback. Because the negative feedback is much more important than all the positive feedback. Someone who is born with a so-called silver spoon in their mouth and life goes really well for them for the first 20, 30, 40 years of their life, and then they get laid off, or God forbid they get a heart attack at 45, 50 years old, they can't do that stuff, and they are pretty much psychologically trashed. They've got to rebuild a lot of stuff. In fact, when we had the first wave of significant layoffs in the auto industry, maybe 25 or 30 years ago, people had no skills. They've been very successful ever since they were out of college. That was the first major setback they have, and it was a catastrophic setback for them.
That's
they
right.
had no skills, no psychological skills, nothing to bounce back from. Then, of course, no one's hiring someone in their 40s, 50s, and 60s, so they can't get a job. So it's important to have some kind of measurable negative feedback, some kind of pitfalls, some kind of stumbles early on to build you those resilience skills. So you still have the ability to have confidence in trying something new. And if you don't achieve what you want, then you use that as an extra stepping stone to get further ahead. So it's more important to be confident in your own abilities to succeed despite setbacks as opposed to just being confident in general.
Confidence comes from dealing with adversity and setbacks. That's what really builds it. There's a very strong argument for that. We've all heard the argument that you have to kind of believe in yourself before you can succeed. Mm-hmm. Yes and no, because that can be a trap. Because how do you believe in yourself if you haven't succeeded? You know, that's the chicken and egg thing. Concept that I came across in looking at this is somebody wrote that defining confidence as just or merely displayed ability. This is something that you were just getting at, that is what confidence is, so that you can – it's something that you don't just have. You develop gradually. So that if you have some proficiency, say if we're talking about learning to play tennis, if you can develop some proficiency in the first few sessions, just getting the ball back, whether it's in the lines or not, having the racket meet the ball and feel and focus on your success in doing that. That's going to get you back the next time with a sense of confidence. And practice then is what makes turns confidence into success. But if you define confidence just as a mere ability that you're displaying, and define the ability not as being, you know, a championship tennis player, but just as where you are, and showing that you have skill in one particular beginning step, that's where confidence begins.
Yeah, confidence is not really self-esteem. Some people think it's the right. Same thing. Have a good feeling about yourself, and that's confidence. That's not really confidence.
Yeah.
And a lot of people think that sometimes a person has too much self-esteem. Well, it's not possible to have too much self-esteem. You just have self-esteem. If you have too much self-esteem, we don't call that too much self-esteem. We maybe call that narcissism or egotism or some kind of distortion. Or too little self-esteem. Well, I'm not sure it's possible to have too little self-esteem. You just have an inappropriate self-perception of what's going on. But confidence is not self-esteem, as Mark talked about. Right. Confidence is born by putting the iron in the fire.
Yeah,
you can have a lot of self-esteem by being alone in your house and never leaving. Mm-hmm. You go outside and mix up with society, and you can find your self-esteem plummets because you have no skills for that kind of interaction.
Well, if you just use the motto of a baby learning to walk, there has to be a lot of falls. That's what develops some confidence in the child trying again and eventually getting their feet under them.
Mm-hmm. Let's go back to the parenting for a second then. So building self-esteem and confidence, I'm just thinking back to my own mother. My whole life, you can do anything. She was my biggest confidence builder. I mean, as I grew up, I went, wow, I wasn't afraid to try anything, probably mm-hmm. because she had told me, just like the opposite, when you say, you're no good, you know,
exactly.
You believe that. And my mother convinced me I could do anything. Mm-hmm. So I don't know, is that confidence, that self-esteem? What is it as parents we want to try to instill in our children?
Well, as parents, you always want to be supportive of your child, and you never want to throw your own kid or any family member. You don't want to throw them under the bus. You don't want to betray them. You don't want to indicate that you don't believe that they can do anything. And most parents err on the side of inadvertently saying something like that. The Sissy Spacek, who is a famous actress, mm-hmm. tells a story when she was a child, she called her mom out of the house, and she was in the Midwest and wanted to show her mom a cartwheel or something she was very proud of. And her mom said, oh, Sissy, you've wasted my time. I have so much work to do. Mm-hmm. And so she said, I've never forgotten that, and I try not to waste anyone's time anymore. And I thought, ooh,
oh,
poor kid.
Yeah. Yeah.
So it's sometimes by accident people's parents say something. It is devastating to the child, and they have no clue.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and the kid is not going to remember it if they ever go in therapy years later, because that's, you know, forgotten 10 years ago. They don't know how to do that. So it's very important to try and be very measured in your response, but always try and go positive.
Sure.
And even if you are negative with your kids sometimes, it's important to remember that there's some research that indicates that if you yell at your child, if you're negative with your child, I'm not talking about spanking or any kind of physical stuff, even if you just speak harshly to them, that has more of an impact negatively than later coming and apologizing. Does not have the same kind of restorative effect. Now, who hasn't raised their voice at someone or heard someone raise their voice in the family?
Mm-hmm.
It's extremely difficult to always maintain your kind of equanimity in the real world because of the pressure that people have. So understand that. And you have to do your best to always try and be positive. You can be positive not 100% of the time, but you can be positive more often than not, and that will be enough to help the child get through. No one has to be 100% consistent in doing anything, because that's, first of all, an impossible task in nature, and secondarily, because the reinforcement schedules that we researched in psychology, 100% of being consistent is not the kind of consistency people need. They just simply know they have to rely on something.
Sure. Yeah, you're talking about being consistently supportive, and you can't be 100% supportive. You have your own feelings and reactions, too.
And sometimes you have to say, no, that's not going to work. And no, right. You know, you cannot jump off that using that sheet as a parachute. No, come down here now.
That's
you know,
right. So.
866-999-4626 is our toll-free number if you'd like to chime in. 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. So what impact does perception have?
Well, you're talking about self-perception or others' perception?
Both.
That's the first thing.
Yeah.
Well, self-perception, I think, is the ability to see yourself as others see you in context of whatever you're doing. And also self-perception is your ability to fairly accurately identify your own strengths and weaknesses and be self-aware. So self-perception is really self-awareness.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely right when you're talking about the interpersonal and success with people. There is some interesting research about success with specific acts. There's some research that shows that people are athletes who are on a hot streak, say in golf or tennis, actually tend to perceive the ball as larger than it actually is. They're able to do some clever research to show that they're the way they experience the ball is different. Or in golf, the hole, say, is being larger. So one of these psychologists came up with the idea, well, can we manipulate this? Can I improve people's putting, say, with golf, by trying to alter their perceptions? And cleverly, she came up with a putting green inside, I guess, that had the standard size hole. But around it, she projected from the ceiling small circles. That would make, and when you look at things, we always compare. So that would make the hole actually look bigger than it actually is to the putter versus the other setting where large circles are projected as images around the hole. That would make the hole look smaller. Well, it turned out that no matter what the people's golf ability were, they were more accurate when they were putting toward the bigger hole as perceived than the smaller hole. So perception makes a big difference in terms of how you actually perform, how your muscles are coordinated, I think is the message we can take away from that.
Yeah,
you can apply that to the interpersonal realm.
Right. Mark has talked about a really interesting experiment. When we talk about experimenters' desire to manipulate self-perception, that is really kind of the focus of a focused attention that hypnotists use, mm-hmm. that clinical medical hypnotists use to change a person's perception. And really all hypnosis is, there are many different definitions. The one I use is, it's really an intensely focused perception on whatever it is you choose to focus
attention,
on.
Attention, yeah.
Right. And you focus your attention on that, on whatever it is that you're doing, and that really changes your perception. And that's how you can change it yourself. Sometimes it's really helpful to have a coach manipulate the environment to give you a leg up on how to do that. You don't always have to go to a hypnotist. But manipulating our own perception and focusing our attention, and it all comes really back to awareness. You know,
sure.
We have this wonderful, wonderful tool in our head called our brain, and most of us just don't use it for any sense of awareness whatsoever. We're on automatic pilot, and we sort of are dimly aware of stuff. We just don't use our attentional ability as well as we might, and that can really alter our perception.
So how does positive thinking play into this? Because I'm thinking, as you're talking about the golf research that they did, I was thinking, and I've told this story before, I used to ski on a ski team, and we'd ski at night after work, and we'd race down this course, and it would get icy. And I remember one of the guys on our team who skied at Penn State, he'd be at the top going, don't let that ice get you. You're going to get that ice. And, you know, you're thinking, I'm going to totally fall. And every time he'd give us that pep talk at the top, we'd get down there, we'd have the best runs, and we'd go, I can't believe it. Mm-hmm. But, you know, he got us thinking, get that ice. You don't let it get you. And you did it.
Well, we have studied going back a long time that indicates that talk therapy, which is kind of what he was doing, or any kind of talk counseling, actually changes the chemicals in your brain, actually does change your perception, actually does do the same thing as the experiment that Mark was talking about and when I talked about what the hypnotists do. So just by hearing someone else say something, you can go along in your head and say, yes, I could do that. But if you had, or anyone else in your group had said, not going to happen, well, then
we'd all be
correct.
Falling.
You're right. You'd be correct on that. So, yes, we can talk ourselves into doing things. And going back probably to the earliest recorded history that we have, philosophers are always giving sage advice. And their advice always was change your attitude, change your thinking, control your thoughts. Don't focus on the bad things that are happening. Focus on the good things that you want to happen. And now in modern day, we talk about don't focus on the problem. Focus on the goal. Focus on the solution. And the criticism I have about a lot of people who conduct psychotherapy is that they tend to memorialize the problem. They tend to sometimes reinforce the pathology. They're focusing on the problem. You really want to get someone past that. We have medication to help people get past that, not to make them get worse again. And therapy should really be helping people to get past that. And that's really what the original self-help movement was all about, people thinking that they can.
Yeah,
was that
yeah.
the little steam shovel? I think I can. Yeah, right. I think I can.
Yeah, sure. And the example you gave about the skiing brings up something I think we'll get to later, or maybe now. That to be successful, you have to have two beliefs. One is that you're superior in a way, that you do have competencies. And number two is the opposite, that you don't, that you're very vulnerable. So here you're approaching the top of the hill with number two, that you're very vulnerable. And the coach, the other skier, is encouraging you to believe that you do have the capacity to rise above it. Two powerful motivators. One is a positive and one is fear does motivate us, fear of failure. So he was emphasizing the positive over the negative. But the negative is still a factor and an important factor in achieving success that is part of the equation. And you don't want to ignore it. You want to actually embrace it, but also get yourself on the positive side.
Yeah, there's some research indicating that, you know, we have this field of psychology called positive psychology, and positive psychology is a branch of psychology that is just not Pollyanna saying just think positive. It's a whole series of techniques that you can use. But one of the interesting outcomes of research into learned optimism or just optimism is that people who are eternally optimistic, they tend to have very unsuccessful personal relationships.
Really?
Because when you're the person who is always optimistic and you're with someone who's kind of negative, kind of like a screw up, kind of like maybe what the old Western songs talk, you know, a good woman with a bad guy always keeps on doing these things. And the optimist says, well, you know, I can rise above this. I can deal with this. I can forgive this person and I can move on. And in the research lab, that works fine. But in the real world, the person you are doing that, you are enabling the person because the first thing they think of is, okay, I guess I can do this again. Nothing bad is going to happen. I know what the consequences are.
That makes sense.
So being an eternal optimist is really not optimal for your success. And you do have to have some fear of the possibility of failure, as Mark talks about. And you do have to be able to say no. You know, you can't use that as a parachute, get down. You have to have some common sense on this. So all the research that we have about how you can be successful has, as Mark talks about, a double-edged sword. Yes, you can, and you have to be prudent in your abilities. So you really can't fly unless you use an airplane, a jetpack, or something. Let's be sensible about this. But can you accomplish what other people can accomplish? Yes, you can.
That's that third in this triple package of traits, the impulse control. That's what you're talking about.
Yes. Right.
Well, sometimes it's impulse discontrol, I guess. Let's talk a little bit about maybe the granddaddy of...
We're going to talk about that after a break.
866-999-4626
is our toll-free number. We're talking about the psychology of success. More after a quick break. You're listening to The Point. We are talking about the psychology of success with psychologist Michael Abbruzzese and psychiatrist Mark Whaley. 866-999-4626 is our toll-free number. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. We're talking a little bit about the positive psychology, and I think you want to talk about Napoleon Hill.
Right. We're going to go into the fun part of the show, which is the pop psychology that people are probably going to really glom onto more than the research kind of stuff that Mark and I like to take a look at. The probably granddaddy of the self-help movement, the success movement, the positive psychology, the positive thinking movement for the masses is Napoleon Hill. Napoleon Hill, when he was in his mid-20s, he interviewed Andrew Carnegie, who was still alive. And he basically said, so what do you think was the secret of your success and how did you become successful? And Carnegie was intrigued with the thought of thinking about how he became successful. And he charged Napoleon Hill with writing a book about how to be successful by distilling what Carnegie told him he had done. And also he introduced him to a whole bunch of his friends. And as you know, Carnegie was a very wealthy man. And this was the golden age back in the, early 1900s, late 1800s. And he introduced them to Henry Ford, Thomas Edison, B.F. Goodrich, and a bunch of people that we don't know any longer. And Hill came up, it was about a 20-year project. And he was a journalist, and he wrote stories to sort of keep himself alive. But as he was writing his book, his magnum opus that ended up a little over 1,000 pages when he was finished, of distilling all the positive qualities these guys had in common. And he wrote chapters about them. And just about every self-help guru who's written a book since then has distilled further, and sometimes they really have distorted and twisted what Hill wrote, about the same kind of things. So people who are now in a mastermind group with some new age guru, that really came from Hill. But when Hill talked about a mastermind group, he had something a lot closer to Jung's collective unconscious as opposed to a bunch of people getting around, sitting together talking. But that's what most mastermind groups are now. And he really had a very strong psychological component based on the kind of hydraulic psychological theory that Freud, Jung, and Adler, and all those guys, that was dominant way back in that time. But he talks about gratitude. He talks about having a pleasing personality. He talks about being positive. He talks about all the important things we've talked about now that research has finally started getting caught up to. But I encourage anyone to read his book if you can get through it. They have distilled versions, which I don't recommend. But it's on the internet now. It's public domain. You can read, I think he has 16 to 17 different volumes of the book, and together they come up to about 1,000 pages. And he talks about all these things, and you can see some of the best techniques for managing yourself to become successful. And they talk about gratitude, being positive, having skills, helping other people, over-delivering on the service, pretty much the opposite of what we used to on the Cape when we go into a company to get some kind of service. And I would encourage anyone to do that. I'm believing in yourself, having self-confidence that's appropriate, and not being a bad guy.
Yeah. You're coming at it from a different angle is yeah. Malcolm Gladwell, who has talked about luck and practice also. But luck as being one of the key things. And he said, or he developed the case at least, for the people that rose in this golden age of industry, rose to the top, were particularly lucky in terms of the environment that they happened to be in at that particular time. They went from there. But it was really chance. He talked about Bill Gates being so successful in part because of a lot of chance. So we can't ignore luck as an ingredient.
I wrote that down here before you said that. Luck.
Yeah, luck plays a role, but it, how much of a role it plays is really unclear. And I read, you know, all of Malcolm Gladwell's work, and it's very interesting, but I really have to part company with a lot of the suggestions that he's making. I think he's sort of cherry-picking and sort of spinning them to fit his own kind of theoretical perspective. So, you know, Bill Gates was, in the story that Gladwell writes about, one of the few kids who was able to access a computer with data cards back when very few high schools had that. And he cut class to spend all his time in there. Undoubtedly, other kids did too, and we don't know who they were.
Right.
You know, Steve Jobs, we know who he was. He didn't have the same kind of opportunities, but he did okay. He had a stepdad in a garage who encouraged him, told him he was wonderful, that could do anything, and he went out with, his pal Wozniak, and they made the first computer in their garage. But they had a different kind of luck in the fact that Bill Hewitt of Hewlett-Packard thought that took a liking to this kid and gave him a lot of components, extra components from his company that he went on and made his own computer. So he had a mentor in Bill Hewitt. So not so much the luck aspect, but the preparedness aspect is really important, putting yourself in a position to take advantage of what looks like luck to us, but is really just an opportunity.
Opportunity. I was just going to say, you know, but, in some ways you make your own luck. You happen to come across, you think, well, this is a lucky find. I've been introduced to this person or I happen. But you see the opportunity there.
The opportunity is there.
Which, yeah, exactly. And then, of course, we have kind of this innate talent versus practice. So a topic of debate in psychology, what does the latest research tell us about how people acquire high levels of skill? Is it practice, practice, practice?
There is no substitute for proper practice. Innate ability is still getting out of the door when proper practice is down the street and around the corner. You can pretty much condition yourself, train yourself to accomplish anything that anyone else can do. It's going to take probably a lot more hard work on your part. But just having the innate ability, sometimes these people skate. If you're really glib and you're really smart, you're not going to study very much. Well, you know what? The guy who studies and really busts his back to get the good grades, he's going to get probably better grades than you're getting.
Yeah.
It's going to be a lot more hard work for him, but he's going to do that. So you can make the case that it's going to take both, but who's going to survive longer? Probably the guy who has practice because he's had more hardship. He's had to work harder. He knows what to do when a couple of doors get closed, and the guy with the innate ability is going to be, what? I can't believe they said no.
Mm-hmm.
What do I do now?
Yeah, that brings us right into the difference in groups. There are certain groups, ethnic, religious groups, that tend to have a little bit more success than others in terms of how you measure success. Certainly, these are facts. Hopefully, the listeners don't cringe at this.
No pitchforks waiting for Mark at the door. I guess what this means.
Don't cringe that this is racist in any way. But it turns out that by facts, people who come from India in this country usually double the national. Their income, yearly income, is usually double the national average
of the same people of the people from India or from people who are natural Americans.
Compared to people who are natural Americans.
I see.
Mm-hmm. Other groups, people from Iran, Lebanese, and also Chinese are also top earners in this country. Mormons have risen to heights in corporations. And, of course, the other group is the Jewish people who have they're widely or way over representative in terms of Nobel laureates. One third of the Supreme Court that we have now is Jewish. They are award winners in various entertainment parts, industries, composers. So what makes for the difference?
That's going to say why,
So the thing is why. Well, the racist explanation has to do with something about genes and that they just inherently are different. But that's not the case. It isn't an inherent difference. One reason that it's not is certainly there are blacks, Hispanics that do outperform others. It's not like it's all black and white. We have a black president who's very smart, for instance. But the other thing that is more important is these groups rise and fall over time. When you look at, say, the Chinese and you compare how the third generation Chinese in this country do compared to the first generation, the third generations blend in with the rest of the country. They don't overperform compared to the first generations. So what's behind this if it's not nature? What is the nurture or what is the aspect that helps? It turns out that there's a triple package that you referred to earlier. One is these groups have a very good ability to convey three things, three elements to their offspring. One is a superiority complex, that they are special, that they deserve success. Combined with an inferiority complex that they don't really have to, that they can lose this specialness, they can lose this success very easily. So they always have to be on guard and they have to push themselves to succeed. They have to persevere. And the third element is impulse control. When they have high impulse control, they have more persistence, more preservation, so that they will keep themselves at the task and succeed. And when you look at the development of this country, this America is based on these three principles. When you think of revolutionary times, we certainly felt superior, that we deserved to have our own destiny, and we were better than what, say, the English or the Europeans thought of us. But we also felt inferior to that because they had all the culture, they had all the institutions. And thirdly, we had a very strong measure of self, of impulse control, as measured by the, or as exemplified by the Puritan philosophy and work ethic. So we had that triple package, and that's what brought America. Also, when I think about this, I think about the 2013 Red Sox. They had this triple package, I believe. They certainly had a sense of specialness. They certainly had a sense of being vulnerable because they were last the year before. I don't know about impulse control, but it must have been active. It must have been operative there on a sub-level. So it's a triple package. And these are things that we can teach, more or less, and convey to our children in a way that can basically give them advantages.
Well, going back to Gladwell's work, he makes a case. He takes out several families that probably no one knows about unless you live in New York. But he talks about immigrant families. And when they came into the garment district, the dads and the moms really worked very, very hard to try to develop a garment business or something in the trucking field or something like that. And their offspring became doctors and lawyers. Well, you may wonder, why didn't they go into the garment district? Well, because the parents said, no, I'm doing this so you can become a doctor or a lawyer, because back then, being a doctor or a lawyer was pretty much the pinnacle success. And so how many immigrants did you have coming into the garment district? How many immigrants in different districts? And how many doctors and lawyers did you have in the second generation? And then you had the third generation. But Mark is right. What he talks about, the research indicates by the third generation, certainly by the fourth generation, you're not seeing that kind of thing. You're not seeing the kind of pressure. And we know from people who come from very wealthy families, for example, versus the Rockefellers versus the Astors, the money from the Astor family has been so dissipated because they essentially did nothing to replenish it. And many people make the case that some of the Rockefellers, the third or fourth generation, have done nothing to replenish, but certainly some have. So there's, in statistics, there's something called regression towards the mean. So you're going to find a spike in accomplishment through the generations, and then it's going to go back down again. And we call that the intergenerational transmission of success, mm-hmm. or intergenerational transmission of failure. One of the criticisms that people have, and I don't want to have a lot of pitchforks and torches when I say this either side, but one of the criticisms people have about some of the welfare states in America versus European countries is that we're constantly reinforcing people for the intergenerational transmission of not wanting to succeed on their own. Mm. And the people who do have an intergenerational transmission of success, we're really thinking of our children, and we think that's kind of our future. You know, my future is going to be just me and my kids. Well, really, when you think about your future, you have to take the European view, which your future is your children, your grandchildren, and your great-great-grandchildren. The things that you do now, the choices you make in your behavior in your life now, affect your great-great-grandchildren, people you will never see.
Mm-hmm. Sure. Yeah.
So you have to understand that when you're planning for your retirement is concluding, setting the stage for the intergenerational transmission for your progeny.
Right. Yeah. Right.
All right. Just in the last 20 seconds here, I'll tell you, my uncle, when I was in my 20s, I still can see him saying this to me. He said, "You cannot fail if you never give up."
That's quite true.
And I thought that was really good advice. I mean, you know, and he himself has, you know, made money, lost money, had many different businesses, but that was the thing. You can't fail if you never give up.
That's true.
So we'll leave you with that. Psychologist Michael Abruzzese, psychiatrist Mark Whaley, thank you both as always.
Thank you.
See you next month. I'm Mindy Todd. Thanks for listening.
Amy Vins produces The Point with assistance from Jenny Junker. The executive producer is Mindy Todd. Music by Benjamin Verdery and William Coulter. The Point is a production of the Cape and Islands NPR stations, a service of WGBH.